Hi, and welcome to the QuitCast for Writers. This is the show that helps you know what to quit, what to keep, and what to question. My name is Becca Syme, and I am a success coach for authors with thousands of hours in coaching some of the most successful people in this industry. My goal in this podcast is to help you understand why you're not having success if you aren't, and how to double down on the success you're already having. Anyone can tell you what worked for them, and they can say it might not work for you, but they can't tell you why. I can tell you why. Welcome to the QuitCast. Today, we are going to be talking to a very special guest about sustainable project management in our author career. If any of you have been coming back to everything, starting to attend in-person conferences again, potentially attending a lot of virtual conferences or doing a lot of workshops and books, you know that we are all just overwhelmed with everything there is to do. And one of the biggest challenges that we all face is how do I maintain some type of sustainability in the middle of all that? And our goal today is to talk to a professional project manager about some tactics that we can apply to making our businesses more sustainable, given everything that we've talked about in the sustainability series so far. I want to introduce you to Deborah Dunbar. So I asked Deborah to come on today specifically because of your background, which I'll ask you to talk about in a second, but you're also what I would consider to be a famous author. Maybe you don't consider yourself that way because you're high significance, but like I love your books. I've read your books. What do you write? What's your primary genres that you write in?
I started 10 years ago. I launched my first urban fantasy novel. And although I've like, you know, urban fantasy, a little more romance, urban fantasy, a little more dystopian, I've kind of like stayed in that general bubble. And then 5 years ago, I started writing cozy mystery under a pen name. So those are really my two big genres right now.
Nice. And then the reason I have you here today is both because of that and also because you have a background that is very unique for authors. And can you talk to me a little bit about what that background is?
Sure. When I got out of college with an English literature degree, I discovered that I'd been putting myself through college doing computer sales in the 1980s. And I discovered that I made way more money in the computer industry and in the business world than I would as some junior editor for Tab Books or something.
Right, yeah.
So I stayed I always wrote on the side, but I always stayed in the corporate world, getting my MBA, sliding from sales and marketing into a human resources related career. And my last job was doing project management I was an internal consultant for a multinational IT company. I specialized in helping our divisions revamp, evaluate, and put together sales commission programs for their sales departments. But I also worked on projects dealing with HRIS and IT focus and executive compensation and defined benefits plans, et cetera. So, yep, basically project management for corporate and HR.
Project management. And then you also have the MBA, right? So in terms yeah. of the person who would approach their author business like a business, you have that from the beginning and are on that, right? What's interesting, so there are several people who have PM backgrounds who are also authors who approach their author business like they would approach their project management, mm-hmm. Which I think is, for those of you who don't know what that is, somebody in corporate decides we need to be more efficient in how we run these projects. And we need individual people who are specialists in how to run projects that will make sure that we get things done in as effective and efficient a method as possible. So that's essentially what you were specializing in, was making sure to get the most essentially ROI out yeah. of the resources that the company gave you to get the projects done in the best way possible.
Yeah. And I have a statistics background in my MBA, which is, it's rare to have a human resource person with an analytical background. Usually those two things don't go together very well.
Yes.
So on my team, I was generally the one that was responsible for the analysis. And I loved it. I mean, you know, I'm one of those walkie authors that actually loves the business aspect of this just as much as I like the creative aspect of it.
Yeah. One of the things that you do, and I don't think this will surprise anybody else who's watching who has a PM background, which, by the way, if you do, reach out to me, because we're trying to collect more and more people who know how to do PM work right now. But those of you who have PM backgrounds, whenever we talk about stuff like this, because I used to do project management on some level in nonprofits just by nature, right? Because you have to. You can't afford to hire a project manager. But what anybody who knows the philosophies of industrial and organizational psychology knows is that we're running businesses and eventually we have to make them profitable or they're going to not sustain themselves. And if you're not looking at a business with a profit, sort of profit mindset in terms of how do I make the business make money for me, then you're not sometimes getting objective enough. And so a lot of the PM background people were not surprised when we see things sweeping through the author industry, because it's like, oh, well, but we need to learn how to do this, right? Because a lot of us don't have business backgrounds. So in terms of when you approach your author career and you're looking at return on investment, do you have any, like, are you talking to someone else to get this big picture? Are you doing a lot of it yourself? How are you doing your analytics?
Well, I mean, I do try to talk to as many other authors as I can, and I'm in several other author groups. And, you know, when I do go to conferences, I always try to make, and it's funny because I'm not the super extrovert, but I always try to make time to talk to other authors and get their experience. Because I find that a lot of times when you talk one-on-one with an author, especially over a drink, you really get, like, you know, their concerns and what they're seeing and how they're doing. So I try to gather information that way. But I also gather information just from, like, you know, seeing how books are launching, seeing what authors that I consider big names in certain genres. I mean, not like Stephen King big, but, like, you know, solidly large indie authors, what they're doing. Are they changing genres? Are they slightly shifting what they're writing? And how are those books ranking and, you know, kind of what's happening? Because I'm a number one strategic, I sort of soak all this in. And then without really thinking about it, I sort of get a vision of where I think it's a little foggy, but it's out there. I see, like, what the future is going to look like. And then I have to look at my business and say, what do I want to do about this? And sometimes those are difficult choices to make.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're thinking about something I've seen you do really naturally that I think a lot of people struggle with is when I go to an author conference or I see all of the potential workshops that are available out there, I am not always good at making prioritization decisions for myself. Even, like, there are some really great tools that you can use for how you should prioritize, quote unquote, but it can be hard to apply those tools because you're not always sure for yourself. How do I decide if it's the best for me, though? And one of the things I think Deborah does really well, and again, I feel like this is partly what being in corporate teaches you, that you have to do this. You have to be aware of what's going on some level in the industry, but then at some point you have to stop listening to everybody else and you have to hone in on what really is the best for you. And that may require not listening to things. Sometimes it may require shutting sources down or saying that's for them and not for me or whatever. So some of that is a little bit natural, but I like that you said also, like, I'm looking more objectively, not just are they having success with it, but why is that success potentially happening?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you are then, if you would do a project, like a project management, let's say, for yourself, and you were going to approach it as though, here's all of my PM background and everything I know about efficiency and effectiveness, mm-hmm. What are kind of the first couple of steps that you go through after you've done that assessment and just kind of looking at what works?
Well, I mean, it depends kind of on the project. Yeah. First, I have to say, you know, is this project going to be profitable or not? So I see a lot of people do like audiobooks, for example. You know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, maybe I should diversify into audiobooks. And the thought is, well, if you're going to do that, you need to take a look at what your best-selling series are, because it seems to me that the ebook ranking and sales is directly related to how successful your audiobook sales are going to be. And it's a huge investment. I mean, you know, you're putting down a couple thousand dollars, if not more, on this audiobook translation, and you're not going to see any money and for months, like months, and it dribs and drabs in. I actually have spreadsheets where I run cost analysis on every audiobook I do, and I see how long it takes for the audiobook to turn a profit. And I've stopped doing audio on any but my most best-selling series. It's just not worth it. Sometimes it takes a year for a return on investment, and I don't have the kind of money to do that kind of, you know, I can't sit around and wait for a year or 2 years for something to even break even for thousands of dollars. So, I mean, there's a lot of that goes into it, but I have spreadsheets where I do my analysis. I use Trello quite a bit. And because I also have multiple projects going. So I'll do that where I can assign due dates. When do I expect this to come in? When do I expect that to come in? I use a word called Word Tracker app. So I put in when I want my book to release, how often I write, and it'll tell me the approximate, you know, words I need to write in a 5-day period consistently to make that. And if I get a little behind, it tells me I need to do X to catch up. So I use a lot of apps and technology to keep on track of things.
Yeah. And it's pretty amazing, even just how instinctive this was for you to answer in literally like the way that a lot of us don't think to answer, which is, would it be a good investment even of my time and money to do this? Like, so many of us don't even consider asking that question, because what we hear is, oh, there's money in audio. Oh, there's money in translations. There's money on TikTok. There's money in Kickstarter. There's money wherever. So clearly I should be doing that instead of, well, but like, do you have a product the market wants? Mm-hmm. Have you done the low cost, like the lower cost testing to know for sure? This is something I think that corporate does really, really well that authors struggle with is R&D. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know how to decide whether or not they should spend money on something, because they think that tactics are the things that sell books, but books sell books. And tactics make book sales better if the books are already worth, like, not worth selling, like some books aren't worth selling, but that the market has decided it wants right now, which is a very different thing from a book is worth selling. There are plenty of books that are worth selling that don't sell.
Well, and things like with TikTok, when TikTok first came on, I love TikTok. I have to delete it because I get sucked
in. I love it so much.
I want to see crazy grandmother videos all day.
I know, right?
And get nothing done. But I first looked at it because I was like, huh, I'm always on the lookout for new social media and how it plays out. And at first I was like, well, you know, it's a little clunky, but, you know, things grow and evolve. But once I got in there, I realized that in order for me to really make a dent on TikTok, not only would I need to regularly release videos, but those videos have to be very tailored. You need to watch TikTok a lot broadly, find out what's trending. I mean, are stitches trending? Are thirst traps trending? I mean, find out exactly what's trending and then pivot your videos to take advantage of that trend. And those trends in TikTok are come and go very quickly.
So
this
fast.
Is something you can just do. Like, I mean, you have to be on that app, you know, daily, or have somebody who is on that app daily to know the trends and know how to position your videos and know how your follows and your views can affect what your video gets shown at. I quickly decided that I just didn't have time to make that work. And if I was going to do it, I needed to make it have a positive ROI, which meant I needed to do all these things.
Yes.
I wasn't going to spend I do have, you know, spoiler alert, I do have a couple of videos up there.
Right. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And I thought, well, you know, if I just do this now and then it's truly a waste of my time. You know, if I'm just posting a video like every few weeks or something like that, Unless it's just fun for me energy.
It gives me energy pennies by all means.
Yes. Yeah, then it's not earning me any money unless I do all the things to tailor my approach. So that's the kind of thing I do when I evaluate. So, you know, everybody's like, I'm making all this money on TikTok, and I get a little green and envy. And then I'm like, well, no, I made that decision because I simply didn't have the time to do it right.
Yeah.
And there's no sense in doing it halfway.
Well, and here's the PM in you, right? This is why I wanted you specifically to talk tactics a little bit, is because the way the project manager would approach a project is, mm-hmm. do we have the resources to pull this off? Mm-hmm. And if we don't, can we go to corporate and get more resources? Mm-hmm. And if we can't get more resources, or if putting more resources in means the project has to make 10x instead of 4x, mm-hmm. are we likely to make 10x out of this project? And then will it be worth them investing the extra $250,000 in us on this?
Yeah.
And people who don't have that background, they have a really hard time evaluating whether or not something is worth their own time.
Yeah.
Just because they're like, well, but everybody says I should be doing it. Doesn't that mean that I shouldn't I just throw myself into TikTok? And I was like, well, first of all, do you naturally like it? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the former, you know, executive director in me, right?
Yeah.
Do you actually like it or not? Because if you don't like it, it's going to cost you more energy pennies to get it done than it is if you like it. So that's the first question. And then if you don't like it, maybe only do it if you can either hire someone else to do it, or if you know someone who loves it, who will do it for you for free.
But then you have the cost of hiring somebody.
Of hiring,
which on TikTok needs to be even more to cover the cost of the person you hired.
Right. And then additionally, you have to ask questions beyond that. Like, are there examples of people selling what I'm selling, mm-hmm. that are making enough money that it would be worth my time to do it right now? Because it's also possible that as the trends come and go, if I, let's say, open the account and claim my name, like everybody says to do that, I still think that's a good idea. And then when I see that there's some stuff that's trending that I'm more like, then go more aggressively into videos. But again, assuming if you like it, you're already going to do it and just go ahead and do it. Or if you're an early adopter and you want to experiment, just go ahead and do it. But there's so much about this evaluation piece that's missing from our author life, because most of us don't have corporate background, or even just like, because most of my experience is in nonprofit, which I feel like is even more aggressive about not spending money, because I'm like, we're not making money off of this. So I have to make sure that every single thing we do is absolutely necessary to our mission, or else we don't do it. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I tend to, I'm not a risk adverse person. I'll throw some money at that and see how it happens. But kind of my ultimate decision on TikTok had to do with, I think a lot of people don't stop and think, do I have the time to do this? And what is it taking away from if I do spend the time to do it? And in Sarah Cannon's HV90 program, she has like a little worksheet where you look at your day. How many hours am I working each day? Because of course there's things like sleep and food and family time. You know, how many hours am I working each day, and how can I break that up? And once you start adding it up, you're like, wow, so there's not 40 hours in a day. And I mean, I looked at my time and I thought, you know, with running all the business end of my author stuff, with my production schedule as far as writing goes, and all the other priorities that I have in my life, TikTok, there's nowhere to squeeze it in where I can devote the time I need to it. So then the question came, am I going to make more money on TikTok if I cut any of these other pieces out? And the answer was, I don't think so. Off it went.
Yeah. And the objective evaluation I do think is really important, which means we have to disconnect the part of ourselves that is like, but everybody's making money on TikTok. The first thing, and again, this is not don't do TikTok. I am actually a really huge fan of TikTok for certain people right now, where I've actually coached people recently and said, if you have the money though, to just hire someone to do it for you, even if you don't like it. Like, I've actually encouraged people, just try it out because you're in such a good fit for what's trending right now. Yeah. And then, and of course, like, there's always evidence of people who are not the thing who are doing it. But the key question for me at the beginning is always, do you like it or not? Because some of us really like the new and different thing. Like you said, that I'll just throw money at anything to try it. Mm-hmm. That's me. I like that initial, like, let's just test and see what happens. But I also know I will quit very quickly if I don't see an ROI on something. Yeah. And I think you're like that too. It's a strategic thing. Yeah. And if you are not like that, then you shouldn't start to begin with. Because if you will, and I mean this about anything, I mean it about classes and ad systems and every our stuff. I mean about literally everything. If you don't like it enough that you will keep doing it until or figuring it out if it fails, I wouldn't do it right now because there's just too much. But I also like that what you said was like, I want to throw money at it to see what the results are. Mm-hmm. Because if I see that there's big results for me, then I will keep going. And I hear that inner PM going like, oh, but there's ROI here. Potentially there's ROI here. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if again, I'm not in genres where TikTok's like, oh, perfect fit. I mean, I think I could kind of squeeze in there. But I just don't think the ROI would be there. And the same is true with other things. Translations are extremely expensive. And right now, the one series I have that sells really well that I think might do well with translations is very, like, it's got like a lot of trendy puns and, you know, it just, I don't think it would translate that well. So I've kind of held off on translation, even though I see people that are making very good money on translation. It's not just genre. Sometimes you have to have the right series in the genre and it has to be selling well. So there's all these factors to weigh in before, and it's not just money, it's time, spending your time on all this when you could be doing something that you know is, you're writing the next book, you know, is going to generate some money.
So. Right. This is the thing too, that kills me when we're like, well, let's just try it. And I'm like, but can you actually afford the time to do it? Yeah. Because if all we're doing, like, the HB90 thing where she's like, well, let's assume this project is this 90 days and that project is that 90 days. And now you plan for 540 days. Right. And I'm like, oh my God, I do that all the time. But I also am strategic enough that I will eventually stop everything else and only work on that one thing. Cause I know I'm not going to get far if I try to partly do, you know, 10 different things. But from a perspective of like, we often don't think about the opportunity cost, where sometimes when you take the thing, you take the step and you spend the time, you can't get that time back. And if we don't do any form of evaluation, even if it's just intuitive evaluation, because not all of us will like the spreadsheets and that's fine. But sometimes I think even just talking to someone who likes spreadsheets can help to ask the right questions, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's talk then for a second. There were a couple of things that we've discussed in the past that I wanted to just hit because I feel like project managers get this in a way nobody else does. Mm-hmm. And one is when we talk about the organizational growth curve, mm-hmm. and how organizations grow and then need to put resources back in and then they grow again, right? And sometimes mm-hmm. they get caught and stuck. And you made a comment to me the other day about 1% growth, that I was like, oh my God, I feel like everybody needs to understand this so much. So when you think about organizational growth from a PM perspective, mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about that just a little bit?
Sure. I mean, new organizations starting out, you're always going to have double and sometimes triple digit growth because you're starting from zero. So guess what? You know, if you earn
500% of two
year,
is only yeah, six,
you can
be but like, it's still 300%.
3,000 next year, you know, I mean, and that's true even in, you know, larger organizations, you know, when once you start getting those new products out, you're going from zero and so you're seeing some really large growth. And as you find your customers and find your readers and your niche and your community. You see that growth early on, and it depends on, sometimes it happens fairly quickly. It depends on the industry. Sometimes it can take decades, but eventually you reach the point where your business is a mature business, and a mature business does not have that growth curve. Lightning can strike. We can all win the 1.9 billion Powerball. You know, we all have a chance of getting that.
And then you can hire Deb to run your business for you. No, I'm just kidding. I'm joking.
I'm not promising those results.
No, she doesn't want that. Yeah.
But, you know, lightning does happen. And so there could be that person and you're like, but this person, you know, released that one book and made $1 million that year. And it was on Oprah and they got a film deal and all. And it's like, yes, somebody's going to eventually win that Powerball. Yeah. And all, but you can't bank your luck on that. You have to look at like other businesses. And generally when businesses get to this mature growth curve, they have something called organic growth. And organic growth is, it's just, you know, these are our products. This is what we do. Every year we release this and we can expect generally a 1-2% increase per year. And that's considered really good. Flatline growth is very normal. Slight dips from year to year are incredibly normal. But, you know, so think that 1-2% growth is an average. You're going to get a lot of teeny, teeny little dips in there. Hopefully, if you get anything that's a big dip, you can pivot and make some changes. But, you know, I know so many people that are, and me included, sadly, that have gone on and are still trying to expect, you know, 30% and 40% growth per year when they're not a startup business anymore. They're a mature business. Yeah. So I've started doing that. I've started redoing my financial expectations as a 1-2% organic growth per year.
Yeah. And honestly, 1-2% of $250,000 is a decent amount of money, right?
I'll take that.
Like that may be more financial growth than you actually made your first year of growth. And we don't think about that because we get so used to this, like, oh, but I did 100 and then 100 and then 100. Mm-hmm. And now I'm doing 25 and I'm mad about that. And I'm like, right. But that is actually a sign that you're in the right spot. Yeah. Like you're doing it correctly. And then they go from 25 to 1 or 25 to 2 mm-hmm. or 25 to -1 because they had to hire a project manager, right? Yeah. Like, because again, like that's why the organizational growth curve exists, is that when you go back into the negative years, the hope is that you are investing or changing so that you can grow again. So let's talk about what actually happens in that dip. Mm-hmm. There are two options, right? Either you have to reorg on some level or you have to what I call pro-org, which is like, I have to build organization.
Yep.
So it's either I'm going to scale or I'm going to sustain. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to sustain and reorg, what might that look like for writers?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of choices that you have if you're seeing, you know, flatline growth or dipping growth. And the one is yes, I'm going to sustain. And that's, you know, I like what I'm writing. I have a significant, strong fan base that is the readership base that likes what I'm writing. So, you know, if you look over the years and you say, yes, I think I can continue to have this kind of even, then you just plan for that. You think about what can I write that is going to satisfy my current readership in the best way possible. So if you have the 5,000 true fans, you know, that just love what your books are, make sure that every planned series or release is going to satisfy those people, because that will keep your earnings stable. Likewise, when you think about new product offerings, think about what is going to satisfy those people the most. I did a Kickstarter this year where I did special editions and I had 109 pledgers. And out of those 109 pledgers, about 90% of them were my current readers. I didn't get like a huge bunch of random Kickstarter people. But I made almost $10,000 on that Kickstarter, and they were all buying these special edition hardcovers and paperbacks with illustrations that I had commissioned from different artists about the book. And it's three books in a set, so they're big, hefty doorstoppers.
Oh, nice.
And I offered an option where I sign them and send them out with some swag. And my existing fans who have read all my books already were happy to put out money for these lovely new editions.
Just on a side note, this Kickstarter is one of the tactics that I suggest the most for people who feel like they've hit that 1% growth of, or 1% or 2% growth, where I'm like, I have to sustain and engage or maybe re-engage my current fan base into something. And then thinking of something like a Kickstarter as a way to provide those fans with a new opportunity to re-engage in your, some people use Kickstarters for growth, but what I like them for the most in terms of what I've seen the most success objectively in coaching with is definitely a sustaining process. Yeah. So I love that tactic. And then what happens if I have to reorg? Like what happens if I have to retrench?
You know, and I mean, that takes a hard look at your numbers. And here I go in the spreadsheets again.
I love them.
You need to really look at your past series. You know, each of those books that launched in the series, book one and then further, what did they earn that first year that you launched them? You know, and then compare series to series. Did certain series do better than other series? Did some series really flop? Maybe you can retrench and say, you know, I kind of lost my way. I started writing, you know, lower heat books and my income's fallen off, but these books here that had a higher heat did seem to sell better. So maybe you can do a little pivot in that direction. And then there's the lovely idea of cutting costs. And it's sad and it's hard, but I took, you know, a really hard look at what I was spending. And I was like, do I need that software? You know, do I need this assistant? I had a person who was very, very good, who was doing my Instagram for me. And I didn't have the money to continue on with that. And I'll be honest, there was no difference in my income from having her do the Instagram. It was a reader retention kind of thing where existing readers could get a constant reminder of like what's going on and what's happening. But it was not bringing in new readers. And I had other ways of retaining my readers that didn't cost X amount per money, you know, per month. So, you know, I let people go. I closed down projects that I thought just weren't going to make the money. You know, a series that I thought was going to do well, that I thought about doing audio in, I decided not to at the last minute.
Yeah.
It's not earning enough to spend that.
We stopped coaching, right? Yeah. Like you stopped coaching. And I was like, yes, I think that is the right idea. As much as I love seeing you all the time, because I think you're brilliant and I love your books, but I was like, yeah, I feel like that's a really good idea for your business right now. Cause I always know when you start growing again, you're going to be right back because on a growing level, that level of executive coach pushing can be really helpful. Yeah. But man, when you are looking at what to cut, you have got to be realistic about what's actually providing ROI for you in
And the dollars add up, you know, those $20 software subscriptions, you know,
$150 conferences, $500 conferences.
Yeah. Next thing you know, you've got $500 a month. And then with the conferences last year, I did no conferences.
I know it was so scary.
Oh, and that's hard for me because it's not just conferences. I do something I call writecations, which are basically writing retreats. I don't always have other people go with me. Sometimes it's just me and I rent a cabin out in the woods for a week and I get a lot of writing done. I'm high ideation. So I need a change of scenery in order to really get my muse going. I cut all that out. I was like, my change of scenery is the back patio, you know, because that doesn't cost me anything at all. Yeah. But I cut to the bone with my costs and doing that allowed me to stabilize my income, my profit and loss to a point where I was able to think long and hard about my, you know, what I'm writing and where I'm going in the future without that, like, oh my God, am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? fear.
Right. Because again, you're still going to be able to write through all that. And that's the key, is like, if you can do everything you can to protect the writing itself when you know you're in those retrenching times, because, and I know Deb knows this, but like, this is how corporations have to act. Yeah. You have to be aggressive about what you cut. And yeah, you're going to miss out on stuff. Absolutely. Like, I'll never forget the networking opportunities we had at NINC, because we were all sitting at that just table out in the middle of, you know, whatever. And then it's like, oh, but I didn't go to NINC this year. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a, you know, a retrenched decision. And it paid off because you're able to maintain the writing of the books because you made that choice. And I think so many of us see like, oh, but I can't do this. What happens if they say something? I'm like, you'll hear it. Yeah. If they say something like, you know, everybody's talking about TikTok, everybody's talking about Kickstarter, you're going to hear about it. Don't worry. Yeah. But you don't have to be physically present in that place. Like, we're seriously considering whether our conferences are worth it for people or not right now, because there's so much retrenching that's going to happen in a recession. And I think a lot of people are like, don't think about it. Still, like, I'm still going to just keep spending like I'm not, you know, hemorrhaging money. And I'm like, okay, then maybe just ask the question. And again, it's everybody's different. Everybody makes their own choices, but, we, you know, when we see authors struggling, I'm always like, how can we help that though? And I feel like this conversation specifically, was key. And the other conversation we had that I think was really great. So next week I'm going to cover what we call our sustainability archetypes in on the QuickCast. Like, I'm going to do, you know, a whole big episode on it. But when I first started talking about this and designing it, Deb and I had a conversation that really changed the way that I was thinking about it, specifically because of something you had been dealing with in what is my takeoff going to look like from here. Yeah. Right. And so, you had, and I wanted to give you credit for this, because when I talk about the plane, and or rocket ship, depending, because I had a conversation with Russell Nolte at RAM last week where I was like, okay, maybe we have another one. But anyway, just the idea that not all paths to publishing have the same pace.
Yeah.
And when they don't have the same pace, and you're in a pace right now where you might be on the scenic route a little bit, and I'm not maybe on the airplane the way that I see is possible. Mm-hmm. It's so important to know when we talk about retrenching that the plane is still available at some point to be. Not being on the plane right now doesn't mean I'll never be on the plane. It's just,
oh yeah.
Like, yeah. Cause your significance is high enough. Like, you need to know it's in front of you still.
Well, or, you know, and I mean, this whole thing was, is my significance is high, and I always wanted to be the author that makes $1 million a year and everybody knows my name, you know, like Cheers. Everybody knows your name. So that's what I wanted to be. And so, you know, my goal is to be $1 million a year author. And I've been in this business 10 years now, indie publishing, and it's frustrating to me that I am not there yet. And so I sat down, now that I did my retrenching and I gave myself the space in the bandwidth to actually sit down and think about things, I thought, well, what do I really want? You know, what is it? Yeah, $1 million is a goal. And I thought about, it's like I'm in Georgia and I want to go to Maine. Maine is my $1 million goal and I want to get there. And there's a lot of different ways that I can journey to Maine. One of them is I can get on a plane and get to Maine, but there's no guarantee that my plane is going to land in Maine. I could hit a storm midway, end up in Cleveland overnight. And then when I get on the next plane the next morning, it takes me back to Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, it could be an environment where there's no plane tickets and it's right. A lottery system. And I have to like keep hitting refresh, 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 refresh on my keyboard to desperately try and score a plane ticket to Maine. I could spend years of my publishing career hitting refresh on my keyboard, trying to get a ticket to Maine. But there's other ways. People can get on I-95 and also very quickly get to Maine on I-95, but you're on I-95.
Yeah.
It's not a pretty route. Some people might, that might be okay with lots of people. But even I-95, I've been on I-95 going to Maine, and we've circled Trenton a few times because we missed the exit.
Yeah.
Or you could be in a car accident and suddenly you find yourself without a car in Boston or in New York City. And if the worst happens and if you die along the way, you spent the last time of your life on I-95.
In traffic,
in traffic and all. So, I mean, I decided that for me, neither of those options was what I wanted. I want to enjoy the road. I want to enjoy my journey. And that's either taking the scenic route, you know, the slow and scenic route, or for me, it's walking the Appalachian Trail.
Right. Right.
Which is going to take me really long to get to Maine, like 6 months of walking and sweating and carrying a backpack and eating dehydrated food. But I love it. And it might take me more than 6 months, because I could be in Virginia and see a side trail with some amazing views and take a detour. I want that option. When you're on a plane, the detours are not within your power. The detours are unexpected and unwelcome. You can't say, wow, there's something really cute down there on the ground and I'm missing it. And I'm not the people that take the plane. You can walk to North Carolina and then take a plane from there. You know, you don't have to take a plane from Georgia, or you can walk, rent a car and get on the highway in Pennsylvania. There's lots of different journeys, but you have to think beyond the goal. You know, is the goal truly the most important thing to you? Or is the goal important, but getting there, how you achieve the goal, is equally important? So that was kind of my whoa, wake up moment.
Yeah, it's amazing to me, because when I was doing the sustainability archetypes, I had almost, we have one more in addition to that, but I had almost the exact same metaphor. And when you were just, Deb came up with this on her own, like this is not something she heard from me, but we had done sustainability archetype work and it was almost the exact same outline. There's one additional one, but anyway, I'll talk about it next week. But what was fascinating is there are actually personality differences between each one of the four pathways that you could potentially take. But what I liked about what she said that was like, I need to make sure to incorporate that part, was the plane itself, the destination is not promised. And so even if you are the type of person who needs for it to be as fast as humanly possible, and you don't care how painful it is, and you don't care how hard it is, you can still potentially not hit that. And then, like I said, when I talked to Russell, he gave me another thought about the difference between incorporating that. And so I'm excited to talk about that next week, but I love that. When this kind of serendipity happens, I feel like people will think, oh my gosh, I've thought that exact same thing. Like, I would not be surprised at all to hear 10 or 15 of you in the comments say, I thought that same exact thing, whatever, because those of us who are significant and futuristic and strategic and all those things, right? We often think similarly because we see the same stuff coming.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Deb and I talked about before we started recording was like the industry is in crisis mode in terms of how we're feeling about our success. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to normalize and get through the transition where we're adapting to the fact that the gold rush is over, we have got to figure out how to run sustainable businesses into the future. Mm-hmm. And so I have a feeling this talk is going to be something people will be watching this in 2050, and people will be watched. So hello from the future, from the past, hello in the future, from the past. You don't have to worry about the transition part anymore. We're through that. But I have a feeling this is going to be one of the talks that is listened to over and over, because this is going to be the major journey that we're all on for the next 3 to 5 years, is figuring out how to make our businesses sustainable. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, Deb, for this.
Sure.
Just so incredibly helpful. And also, any of you who are former project managers, please do reach out to me. Something that Deb doesn't probably talk about a ton is that she does do some project work for really high level authors. But again, it's like, don't contact her. She's full.
But, yeah, I'm booked right now.
Yeah, she's booked. But what we're seeing in trend is people who have this level of expertise who can help businesses function more effectively are starting to become more and more in vogue in terms of, like, I think this is the next cottage industry in the author world, because a lot of people who have a lot of talent and hard work and luck and timing don't have the ability to run their own businesses anymore because their businesses are so big. Yeah. And so they need to be able to have somebody come in and say, I will help you to organize this and help you to run your projects because I have experience doing that. And then I will also, you know, be compensated fairly for it, because it's a high level of responsibility that you run when you're a project manager. But what I love about this potential sort of cottage industry thing that's coming up is when we were doing this early, like I started doing individual coaching and for classes in 2012 and 2013. Mm-hmm. And what I was seeing was at some point authors are going to need to have this resource. And we need to know that you can't often just pick stuff on your own. Yeah. A lot of us don't have the capacity. This is why companies would hire Deb to come in and work as an independent contractor, is because the company themselves is blind to their own flaws and blind to their own strengths. Mm-hmm. And then they are not being objective when they are evaluating what they're good at, what they're not, and what resources they do and don't have. Okay. And that's part of why we do so much coaching and why we think PMs are so important. And all these is because you often are not the best decider of what is objectively good and not in your own business. And doing the kind of work that Deb's done over the last year is really hard and painful, because you don't want to see the same thing happen in future years. But that's why we do it now. We do it now. Again, Deb's number one strategic.
Number one strategic.
She's doing it now so she doesn't have to pay the consequences for having a poorly aligned organization 10 years from now. So again, just thank you for being you and doing the work that you do. And this has just been so incredibly helpful. Thank you so much, Deb. We appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
She's so brilliant, isn't she? Every time I talk to her about any kind of organization, of anything, you can just feel all of the years of experience that she has in doing work like this and the high levels that she's performed at in major companies in the past. So grateful that she was able to join us today. Thank you so much, Deborah. Please check out her books. Also, they're going to be in the show notes. She also writes Cozy, among other things. And so I'm very excited to have her on. She's also an author, amazing author. Okay. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We will see you next time on the Quick Cast. Thanks again. Bye.